From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The statistics around mass incarceration in the U.S. are depressing. We are a nation that imprisons more people than any other, despite our stated ideals about freedom and democracy. It has become all too easy to reduce the individuals who are impacted as merely numbers. A new book tells the heartbreaking story of a young man who entered the criminal justice system when he was only a child, caught in California's three strikes dragnet. Written by his cousin, it is a true story, one that is related from the point of view of a family member who felt helpless to stop the trajectory of a life ruined. It's also a cautionary tale about the lives that our misguided war on drugs and our vast system of mass incarceration swallows up and destroys. Danielle Allen is the James Conant Bryant University Professor at Harvard University, author of Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in Defense of Equality, and winner of the Parkman Prize. She joins me to discuss her new book. It's simply titled, Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. Welcome to the program, Danielle.
Thank you for having me, Sonali. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Cuz, your cousin, right? His name, Michael Allen. You refer to him as Michael A. in the title of your book. Before we get to exactly what it was that happened to him and why things happened to him, I'm wondering if you can tell me what led you to write this personal story, because as I said, you know, we've had some fantastic books like Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. We've had books that look at this from a policy perspective, but we don't have enough books telling the stories of the actual people impacted. And for you, this is obviously deeply personal.
Right. So I am a professor, and I'm an academic. I'm a political philosopher. My specialty is democracy. What does it take to make sure democracy thrives? And I was invited by Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. at Harvard to give a series of lectures called the Du Bois Lectures. These are named after W.E.B. Du Bois, the early African-American sociologist who worked at the end of the 19th and early 20th century. And the point of these lectures is that you're supposed to offer commentary on the state of affairs for African-Americans in the country in our contemporary moment. And so Professor Gates invited me, and I was honored and delighted to accept. But then I found I kept deferring the dates, and I kept giving him really abstract titles, things like, you know, race and justice in the 21st century, or political equality in African Americans in the 21st century. And finally, Professor Gates just said, look, you know, kid, you're going to have to give these lectures. And so when I had the sort of dates on the calendar, I realized I had been deferring because I couldn't honestly address the topic of the state of affairs for African Americans now without understanding and telling my cousin's story. So it was really that, you know, being forced to answer the question, how are things going for African Americans in this country? The only way I could answer it was by telling Michael's story.
So Michael, who is the subject of your book, you and him are cousins. Your childhood ended up being markedly different from his, and this in many ways sort of is a typical tale, isn't it, of kids who end up in the system who don't have some of the support structures that they really do need in their young lives. Can you tell us a little bit about his childhood first, and then share with us an excerpt from your book? Because I think it's important for people to hear you read it and to get a sense of the writing.
Sure. No, happy to. So, I mean, it's complicated in the sense that we grew up together. So I'm 8 years older than Michael. So there's me, my brother, and then Michael's older brother, his sister, and then Michael, five of us. We are a subset of cousins in a big extended family of a lot of cousins. My dad had 11 brothers and sisters, and my dad and Michael's mom were very close. So we were all in Los Angeles in Southern California. We spent a lot of time together. And in the 70s, there was a sense that we were really sort of in this world together, that there were lots of things that were possible. We would, you know, we were wanting to move up. We were going to move up together. But our trajectories went in very different directions. And the thing that really, I think, was the kind of turning point in Michael's life is his mother, who's a very hardworking single mom, worked her way up to being a nurse, got herself into a house. They had a life that was progressively getting better. She married a man who turned out to be abusive. And the result of that was that their family sort of blew to bits, and they moved many times in 5 years from California to Mississippi to Georgia, then back to California. Michael had 5 mid-year school transitions, and for the last one, landed him in South Central Los Angeles in the early 90s at a point of great violence, increasing gang activity, and so forth, and just a kind of world where kids ages 10 to 14 are incredibly vulnerable. And that was where he got into trouble. And that was where those of us who were around him, his extended family, who did love him, who did have resources to help him, didn't have enough knowledge about what was happening around him and to him to help. So that was a sort of complex situation. My dad was a college professor, so I grew up in a college town, Claremont in Southern California. Michael and his brother and sister and mom spent a lot of time with us there. So the families, sort of, we were together in lots of ways, but also our circumstances were very different. So here's the beginning of chapter 12. Where were you when you were 15? Close your eyes and try to recall. I lived in a bedroom with a brass bed with a blue and white striped Laura Ashley comforter. There were matching valances on my windows, and I had a wooden roll-top desk with a drawer that locked and held my secrets, including dirty letters that I couldn't at the time translate from a German boy who'd been the object of a minor summer music camp romance. I was awkward and insecure, confused about how to find my place in life. Often I was lonely. All of this was true despite the fact that I was hurtling into my junior year of high school as captain of my varsity track team. I was younger than most of my classmates at Claremont High School, and my friends all had their driver's licenses by the start of our junior year. I was not, however, allowed to ride in their cars. The only time I ever got grounded in high school was when my librarian mother caught me sneaking a ride with a friend to get to my French class at the local college. I grew up in a college town, a faculty brat, where everyone knew my mom and dad. My parents had made a critical decision early in the lives of my younger brother Mark and me that regardless of what career opportunities came my father's way, they would not move until we had graduated from high school. I grew up in one place where everyone knew me. I couldn't even get away with sneaking to my college courses. Which of us does not remember what life was like at 15? The torments of adolescence leave indelible marks. 8 years after I got grounded for sneaking to class in that friend's car, my 15-year-old cousin, Michael Alexander Allen, who also didn't yet have a driver's license, was arrested for the first time for an attempted carjacking. A few months later, after he turned 16, he sat in Torrance, California in court, the standard kind with his swinging gates just inside the doors of the courtroom, handcuffed and in an orange suit, in December 1995 and January 1996, as a judge determined that he would be charged as an adult.
That is Danielle Allen. She's my guest today, reading from her new book, Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A., Michael being her cousin. Amazing that we have a country that professes all these ideals about human rights and the rights that people have in the Constitution, and then can charge a child as an adult, something that happens even today. So your cousin was tried as an adult, and California at that time especially was in this frenzy of being tough on crime, and he got caught up in the three strikes law in California. Tell us a little bit about that law and how it put him in this legal position, this 15-year-old boy in this legal position that no child should be in, no matter what they've done.
Sure. So, about 18 months before Michael was arrested was when California had passed the three strikes you're out law, the first of its kind in the country. And at the same time that that law was passed, California was repeatedly lowering the age at which people could be tried as adults. So from 18 to 16 to 15 and finally to 14, just months before Michael was arrested, and for a list of crimes, and that list kept getting bigger, but attempted carjacking were on the list. And so what happened with Michael is he did try to steal somebody's car with a gun at gunpoint. It's a terrible thing to have to say that somebody you love did something like that. And the only good thing that can be said about the incident, and it's hard to say it's a good thing, but the only good thing is that the only person who got hurt was Michael, because the person got his gun and shot him through the neck. And on his way to the hospital in the ambulance, Michael confessed that he had also robbed three people the previous day and somebody else a week earlier. So this was brand new behavior. He had never done anything violent of this kind previously.
And that must have shocked you and his family to even know about this, right?
It was completely shocking. It was completely shocking. So, but because of this, because there, this was, you know, you have to call it a spree. You have to be forthright and say that. It meant that he was facing four felony charges. And so the judge informed him that if he went to trial and was convicted on all the things he confessed to, he would face a sentence of 25 years to life. So the judge recommended that he take a plea bargain. Instead, Michael couldn't make up his mind. He couldn't decide what to do. He asked his mother to decide what to do. And so she left the courtroom and prayed, trying to think through what to do, and decided that he should plead guilty, which he did. And so he received a sentence of 12 years and 8 months. But the backdrop of the conversation was the notion that it was a viable thing that this 15-year-old on his first arrest would be sent to prison for 25 years to life.
So here's a 15-year-old, and obviously, you know, troubled. And I'm wondering what would have happened to him had he been a white child? Say everything else or many other things were similar, but even just simply his skin tone had been different. Because you hear of young white people doing similarly misguided things and being given a second chance.
So, you know, honestly, it's not a question I can directly answer right. In that way. I mean, it is, we all know the facts of the way in which the criminal justice system has disparate treatment of African-Americans and particularly young African-American men in comparison to other groups. And we all know the ways in which the original drug laws and then anti-gang laws and so forth have led to very disparate treatment of young African-American men through policing and in the criminal justice system. So, I mean, there are a lot of different factors that led to Michael sitting there and facing that kind of sentence. I think it's equally important to recognize that a conviction that deterrence was the most important feature of punishment had overtaken the public consciousness in California. So rehabilitation had just sort of been stripped out of the penal system. And the biggest consequences of that move, I think, were for how we came to think about juvenile justice. And that has been the true tragedy here, I think. The notion that with regard to juveniles, we completely turned our backs on the project of rehabilitation.
So tell us then what those 11 years that he ended up serving were like for him in prison. To enter as a child into a prison, and was he in among adults in a prison population? What was his time there like?
So when he was sentenced, the judge who sentenced him wrote to the California Department of Corrections to recommend that he be kept in juvenile until the maximum juvenile age, which was 25 at the time. But for reasons that are completely opaque and inaccessible, he was transferred to adult prison when he turned 17.
So 17, a 17-year-old child in an adult prison. Wow.
And he was also, I mean, in addition to being sent to adult prison, he was sent to literally the prison that was the farthest away from Los Angeles. So he was sent to Susanville, which is on the Oregon border. His mother couldn't get there to visit him, so he had no family visits in his first 6 months in adult prison. And I mean, again, like that's just sort of, it's mind-boggling. I mean, the research confirms over and over and over again that the single most important element of a prison sentence to reducing recidivism is family visits and maintaining family connection. So, I mean, it's really the sort of the punitive spirit that had gripped California meant that the state was even doing things that were against the interest of the people of California. So, I mean, things that are better for prisoners are actually better for society as well. And somehow, you know, how we lost that understanding, I have no idea. But the importance of getting it back could not be more pressing.
What were you going through at this time? So you said you were 8 years older than him. So by the time he was in prison, you were already an adult, and you started to feel like you needed to take some responsibility for your cousin as well and wanted to do everything you could for him.
Well, I mean, you know, it sort of comes in stages. So when Michael was first arrested, I was in graduate school. I was in graduate school in England. So I felt very far away, very unable to do anything to help. But by the time I moved back to the States and then I started as an assistant professor at the University of Chicago, in 1997, I was among the people, other cousins as well, who talked with Michael on the phone regularly, took his calls from prison. Michael had an incredibly lively mind. It was sort of voraciously curious. When he was arrested, he was a junior in high school, and between his arrest in the fall of 95 and the spring or June of 1996, when he was sentenced, he completed his GED. And thereafter, he just really, really wanted to go to college, right, which was an impossibility inside prison. So we talked about that a lot, and finally, I was able to help him find an extension program at Indiana University that permitted him to enroll in college courses. So we spent a lot of time as talk partners, as friends on the phone, working on his college classes over the period of his years in prison. And then I was the cousin who was sort of on duty, as I think of it, when he got out of prison, trying to help with reentry, with job, with housing, with education, and so forth.
What was he like when he got out? Obviously, a different person. He, you know, finished his childhood within prison walls, emerged an adult. What was that person like who came out compared to the person who was sent in?
So, I mean, I think, you know, people sort of need to recognize that prison is an incredibly violent place. And so people who have spent a lot of time in prison have had to learn how to survive. You also have to think of, you know, this is a kid. He went in at 15. He got out when he was 26. One of the most important things that happened to him in prison was that he fell in love. Mm. He fell in love with a fellow inmate, a transgender woman whom I call Bree in the book. And these were all, you know, the sort of probably the most meaningful things.
Of course, one of the things that is the hardest in prison is that lack of human connection that can sometimes set in, especially when prisoners are sent to solitary. And you try to make human connections wherever you can, because that's what makes us human.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think it's important to see, you know, intimacy continues in prison. People form relationships. I think as far as the reentry conversation is concerned, that's one of the biggest and hardest topics that we don't necessarily talk about enough is you can't just think about a job. You can't just think about the education that the prisoner or former incarcerated person needs. You also have to actually think about how does a person transition from one set of relationships to another? How do they make a decision about which relationships they're keeping, which ones they're giving up? How do you deal with the grief that necessarily comes from leaving behind a set of relationships that you've had for 11 years and moving into a different world? So I think that whole question of the relationship between relations in prison and relationships out of prison is one that is just, you know, we need to open up a conversation about.
So, of course, the worst problems, or one of the worst obstacles to getting out of prison, is simply being financially self-sufficient. Yours was a child who didn't get to go through the sort of normal stages that we want for our children to have, and, you know, doing the standard type of education and then getting a job. He's out as a young man, and he needs to be able to find a job. Also, the terms of parole you point out in your book are extremely restrictive, right? So how did that play out, the terms of his parole and his efforts to get a job?
So one of the opportunities Michael did have in prison was to be a firefighter in the California Forestry Department. And so, you know, he did fight what at the time was considered the largest wildfire in California history. I mean, we've now seen these terrible fires this fall in California. But so Michael was fighting, you know, the fires that were of a magnitude related to what we've just seen. And he flourished as a firefighter. He loved the work. It was absolutely the period of time in prison for him where the time flew by, whereas that was not normally what he said about time in prison. And he really hoped to return to that work when he got out. And we had family members in Riverside County who could have taken him in, and he would have perhaps been able to work in a fire camp in Riverside County or something of the sort. But the rule is that you had to parole to the county in which your crime was committed. So that meant going back to Los Angeles County for him. So, I mean, we did find...
And that is such an important issue, because sometimes those same circumstances that made you the person you were when you became first incarcerated exist and can stand in the way of rehabilitation, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the notion that people would go back to the environment where they committed their crime is really counterproductive. I mean, I think it's an example of unintended consequences. You can understand why that was the rule, in the sense that the court system doesn't want to have sort of liability for people who are in a different county. They want to have direct surveillance and so forth of the people that they've sent to prison. So you can understand why the rule springs up, but it's, I think, a rule that does run counter to what would be the most powerful approaches to rehabilitation and reentry and giving people a fresh start. And again, that's where I feel like we just really need to ask the question of, you know, if we're thinking about the good of society, there are places where the good of society and the good of incarcerated people align, they come together. Society is better off if people make it when they come back out again, if we avoid recidivism and so forth. And so I think rethinking the question of how people can have a fresh start, begin again, is just imperative for all of our goods, not just even the good of incarcerated people.
What happened to your cousin? Because the story isn't just about how he got into prison, his time there, and when he got out, but what happened after he got out.
So, the really critical thing in Michael's life is the love of his life, the woman he fell in love with while he was in prison, Bree. So for Michael, I think the hardest part of reentry was making a decision about whether or not to reconnect with Bree and maintain his relationship with her. And that was not something I saw at the time. I did not see that this was going on when I was trying to help him get settled and so forth. It's only looking back that I can tell that that was the thing that had the biggest impact. So after he had been out for about 6 weeks, he got out in June 2006, and by the end of July, amazingly enough, he had a job. He had a job at Sears, working in a warehouse on Santa Monica. And he also was enrolled in Los Angeles Valley Community College, and we got to where we were going to put the third puzzle piece in, you know, the housing, to make it all work. And we found a perfect apartment. It was close to the school. It was close to work, little commute and so forth, and the landladies, the most generous human beings I've ever met. He told his story. He explained who he was, what he had done, that he was pursuing a second chance. His cousin was going to guarantee his rent, support him, and so forth. And they were willing to rent a little studio that they had to him. It's a true act of charity and generosity for which I will be forever grateful. But then after they said that, over the next 24 hours, Michael went back and forth over whether he actually wanted the apartment. I was completely surprised. You know, he called and said, "I'm not sure I want it, Danielle." And I thought, what? You know, how can this be? You know, this is the final puzzle piece. You know, back and forth and back and forth, and finally decided not to take the apartment. And he said to me, "I can't imagine what it would be like if my associates came by." And I didn't know what he meant. I was sort of taken aback by that word, associates. And I didn't ask him any questions because it seemed like a phrase that was sort of insisting on his privacy, insisting on his own decision about the world that he wanted to build. And it was then only a few months later when he told me that he was thinking of moving into an apartment with Bree that I understood that that's what he had meant by associates. He couldn't imagine what it would be like if he brought his girlfriend, a transgender woman he'd met in prison, to this little studio with these nice landladies who'd so generously given him a second chance. So when he was going back and forth that 24 hours, he was making a choice. Was he going to keep Bree in his life or not? And in the end, he chose Bree. She was the love of his life. Over the next 2 years, their relationship became violent, and in the end, Bree is the person who killed him. So he died in 2009 because, you know, Bree shot him in her kitchen.
This story is one story with all the sort of various things that make it unique. What are some aspects of Michael's story, your cousin's story, that you feel are typical and places where intervention can happen? As his family member, as his cousin, you felt helpless to be able to, help him get back on track and live a happy and long life. What are some places, what is the part of his story that you feel is going to be the most constructive and instructive for us as a society when we think about issues of mass incarceration and the violence in communities, the violence of the system, et cetera?
So I would call attention to two moments, the moment of his first arrest and then the reentry moment. So at the moment of his first arrest, his mother wanted to bail him out of prison, and he said no. He didn't want to be bailed out. And the reason he didn't want to be bailed out was because he just thought that he would get into more trouble if he went back out. He felt safer staying in prison.
Wow.
Now, that's a really counterintuitive thought, okay? Hmm. And the prison system, the people, you know, officials and so forth, didn't see what he was telling them, which was that He was a kid who understood that the streets of Los Angeles are dangerous. He didn't want to be involved in what was going on in the streets of Los Angeles, and he did not know how to get out of it. And he needed help for that. And that should have been a moment where that help and support were provided. And he was given, you know, certainly a way of paying his due, so a punishment, absolutely, but a model of punishment like those that are used in other countries, Germany and Australia, for example, where they have, for instance, work programs where people stay in halfway houses. They're given quite hard but meaningful work that teaches a trade, teaches them a way of life. They have to return after the period of work, you know, to spend the night in the halfway house and so forth. But the point is that they're given a demanding piece of work, but also given an opportunity to develop skills so that they can become productive members of society. Whereas you send people to prison, you're basically sending them to a place where the skills to be a productive member of society are just going to atrophy. You're sort of pushing people in the other direction. He was asking for help in that moment of his first arrest, and he did not receive the help that he needed. And at the reentry point, I mean, sort of a related thing, I suppose. Again, you know, it's imperative to think about jobs and make sure that jobs are available for people. And it's imperative to think about schooling and education and housing and make sure that all of those things are available. Nobody can make it without those things. But if we don't also pay attention to the question of how people navigate the move from the relationships they've had in prison to relationships outside of prison, you know, everything else will be pointless. I mean, at the end of the day, you just have to think about that. If you go into prison at 15, you're there for 11 years, how do you just walk away from the relationships that you form there? That is a huge ask to put on people. And maybe that is what they need to do, but if it is, then they also need to be supported through that transition. And I think we've not paid enough attention to the psychological complexities of making that transition from a long period in prison to being back on the outside.
Danielle, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and for joining us on the interview.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
My guest is Danielle Allen. She's the James Conant Bryant University Professor at Harvard University. Her earlier book is Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in Defense of Equality. She's the winner of the Parkman Prize. We've been talking about her new book, Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.